This is iBasics 101, Episode 1, The Basic Eye Exam.
In a world without good eye education, a beacon of hope is born. That beacon is iTalk Radio.
Welcome to iBasics 101. This is an audio program dedicated to teaching you about the eye and ocular disease. No matter if you're a student, a practicing doctor, or just a curious person wanting to learn more about the eye, we can all learn more through thoughtful discussion. My name is Dr. Timothy Root. I'm a general ophthalmologist and cataract surgeon. The show notes for this episode are available at iTalkRadio.com. That's EYETalkRadio.com. If you have questions or comments about today's discussion, just visit the show notes. You can also find it directly at iBasics101.com. But just look for episode one and leave a comment if you have one. But today's topic is the basic eye exam. Now, sight is arguably the most important sense for both survival and quality of life. And the eye exam is quite different than a medicine exam. If you are a medical student or practicing doctor, much of your training to this point has probably involved the basic whole body exam. Now, the eye is quite different. For one thing, it's much smaller. The eye is only about 1 inch in diameter. It's one of the smallest organs we can actually examine. But there's a lot to see, and the reason why is the cornea, that clear window in the front of the eye, lets us look inside the eye, so there's a lot to examine, a lot to document, and it's all crammed into a tiny space. But before we get going on the basic eye exam, I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about the motivation behind this program and why we're doing audio with this. Now, when I was an ophthalmology resident, I had the great fortune of spending a good month up in New York City rotating with a neuro-ophthalmologist. And during that time, I had to create a lot of self-study to try to understand a very confusing topic. Neuro-ophthalmology is one of the more difficult subspecialties to comprehend. And I found a series of audio lectures recorded by the great neuro-ophthalmologist J. Lawton Smith back in the 70s. They were online, someone put them up on the Novell website, and I downloaded all the MP3s, loaded them on my MP3 player, and as I commuted around the city, I would listen to these lectures, and they were pretty dense. I mean, neuro-ophthalmology, talking about neuroanatomy in an audio format was quite challenging, but I did find the experience extremely enlightening and very educational for me. I really enjoyed listening to these lectures and hear Dr. Smith talk to me right in my ears. It was quite moving. Now, I don't know if you've ever had any familiarity with J. Lawton Smith. He died a couple of years ago, but he was one of the great neuro-ophthalmologists of the past 50 years. He worked down at Bascom-Palmer down in Miami, Florida, but he was from South Carolina, and he was famous for his teaching style, and partly because he just had a really interesting way of speaking. He had an extremely dense South Carolina accent, and he would say things like, "Pure as ivory soap," and "You're a rube," and all these crazy South Carolina backwoods sayings. It's really funny. It's strange, the dichotomy between someone with such an accent and yet such a great intellect. But I found the entire experience very interesting. Audio was fantastic. And so I enjoyed the dialogue. I think it made me a better doctor. And I'm not saying I'm a J. Lawton Smith. That's for darn sure. But I did find the experience of listening to audio while I was walking around quite good, because the reality is, you know, I do a lot of videos. If you've ever seen my videos online, I do a lot of online video lectures. You'll find them on YouTube. But people only have so much screen time, so much time where they're sitting in front of a computer screen or looking at their phone for doing that type of stuff, because life is busy. And so I'm hoping that by putting this in an audio format, it'll be portable. You'll be able to listen to it while driving around, walking around, cleaning the house, doing chores. And also maybe a little bit more personal, because I can spend a little bit more time talking to you. And there's also some selfish reasons behind this whole audio endeavor, because the preparation time is much less. You know, when I put together a video lecture, I try to do a good job, but it takes me months to put together slides and record the videos and then edit the audio into it and fix the timings, put it into a downloadable video format, upload it online. It's a big ordeal. And my family's not wild when I go into video mode. But audio, I can probably whip out pretty quickly. And in fact, I'm scheduled to do this bi-monthly. So we'll see if it's quite as useful. But with that out of the way, let's get back on topic. We're here today to talk about the eye exam, the basic eye exam. Now, this is actually a challenging topic, even though it's supposed to be basic. This is challenging. And the reason why is talking about exam techniques is extremely boring. I mean, I dreaded doing this topic, but I knew I had to get it done because you can't really talk much about ophthalmology or optometry without learning how to actually look at the eye itself, but extremely boring topic. In fact, when I was a medical student, they would make us read, I believe it was called the Bates Clinical Exam. It was this big, giant, hardbound book on how to examine the human body, how to percuss the lungs and to listen to the heart and to examine the lymph nodes. It was an extremely boring book. I mean, I bought the darn thing because I was supposed to, but I never cracked it open because it was just overwhelming. I mean, how do you learn the eye exam or the body exam through a textbook? In fact, that book was so big, they gave us a pocket version for carrying around with us, which I did look at. Learning how to do an examination technique is kind of like reading the passenger safety instructions when you're on an airplane. I mean, who really does that? It's really boring. Or maybe reading a manual on refrigerator maintenance. It's not the type of thing that necessarily lends itself towards the written or even really the spoken word. But these things are important, so we're going to talk about it because we got to do it. You got to start somewhere, and this is a good place to start. If you're going to be an awesome doctor or eye doctor, we got to know how to examine the eye. And my challenge, in fact, it's not even a challenge, it's my responsibility to you, is can I present this information in a way that's both educational and still entertaining? And you're going to have to be the judge of that because I don't know, but we're going to do our best, so bear with me and let's get going. The first topic I want to go over are the vital signs. Now, in medicine, the vital signs are what? Blood pressure, the heart rate, temperature, respirations. These are all measurements of essential body functions. And when I say essential, if you have no blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, you're essentially dead, right? Well, oddly enough, despite the importance of these vital signs, in ophthalmology, they're not nearly as important. I mean, if you can walk into an eye doctor's office, your vital signs are usually good enough. Instead, we have completely different vital signs. And I'm not sure if this is something books teach, but this is what I teach my own students. The vital signs of the eye are the vision, the pupils, and the eye pressure. I'll say that again. Vision, pupils, pressure. These are the essential ocular functions. They're essential because if you have no vision, what are the eyes for? Pupils are a nice objective measurement, and pressure is vitally important for glaucoma. Vision, pupil, pressures. Vision, pupil, pressures. It's like a mantra. In fact, you need to get a patient's vision, pupils, pressures before you can put dilating drops in. Which doesn't sound like an important point, but when you're a ophthalmology resident and you get called at 2 a.m. to the emergency room to see a patient, you have to get their vision pupil pressures before you can put those dilating drops in. And those dilating drops are going to take 15 to 30 minutes to work. And so if you want to get sleep, you got to get the vision pupil pressures first so you can get those drops in. And so I kind of felt like the Dunkin' Donut man. I don't know if you remember those old commercials from the 80s, but he would wake up early in the morning and say, time to make the donuts. But it's the same thing with the eye. You know, I got to check the vision, pupils, and pressure. Now, because these are important, let's spend some time on each of these vital signs and go into this in a little bit more detail. Number one, vision. Arguably, of all the vital signs, the vision is the most important function. And interestingly, despite its importance, vision is very hard to measure sometimes, because it is inherently a subjective measurement. You know, one man's blurry vision is another man's clear vision. And so in an attempt to objectify or at least measure a patient's vision, we had to come up with something. And so the most commonly used measurement is the eye chart. How good is their vision? And most doctors use the Snellen eye chart. That's Snellen, S-N-E-L-L-E-N. It was invented by Dr. Herman Snellen back in 1862. But it's basically the eye chart with a big E on the top. And as you go down, the letters get smaller and smaller and smaller. The Snellen eye chart is normally documented as some type of ratio. So a patient with 20/20 vision is considered to be a normal person. But if someone has, let's say, 20/60 vision, what that means is if you have your patient standing at 20 feet looking at the eye chart, if they can only read the 20/60 line, well, someone who with normal vision standing 60 feet back from that eye chart can read just as good. So it's kind of a ratio of how good your vision compared to how someone else with normal vision is. Now, we use the 20-foot marking here in America, in the U.S., But the rest of the world uses different measurements. They're on the metric system, and so they do a meter convention, and they usually do 6 meters. And so let's say 2,200 for us in other countries would be a 660. So it's a same ratio number. It comes out to being the same, just different measurements used. There is another type of eye chart called a Logmar eye chart that is typically used with research. It has a little bit more even progression between the lines. Every line has the same number of letters on it. And so it's probably more technically accurate, but the Snellen chart's pretty much standard. So 20/20 vision, Snellen, that's how we document it. Now, as far as how to measure someone's vision, I mean, it's pretty obvious. You check each eye one at a time, see how well they can read that eye chart. But there's a couple of points I'd like to emphasize here before we move on. The first point is that the corrected vision is really the only important measurement here. You know, people always want to know what's their vision without glasses. It doesn't matter because patient's vision with their glasses or with the best corrected vision is the only thing that's important because that tells us how healthy the eye is. Sure, he may be nearsighted or farsighted. It doesn't matter. We only really check patients with corrected vision. Unless there's some other reason you need to know what their vision is without glasses. For example, the Driver's License Bureau might want to know if this person can drive a car safely without their glasses. And so then we check. But on routinely, I don't always bother checking uncorrected vision because it doesn't really tell me anything. Also, we check one eye at a time, typically. And you can do that by using the occluder, a little paddle that covers one eye at a time. There's also the paddle that covers both eyes and has a little hole in the middle of it. The important thing when checking someone's vision at one eye at a time is people cheat. They will totally cheat. So you really have to watch them closely, which is why the occluder paddles are good because you know they're not peeking between their fingers. You have to watch little children especially because they will cheat at a drop of a dime. They're not being malicious. They just do it. Also, some of our older patients, especially in glasses, their hand will drift and they don't realize it either. So one eye at a time. This is obvious stuff, right? Another technique we use is the pinhole technique. If you have a patient who doesn't see perfectly, one trick you can do is have them look through an occluder that has little tiny holes punched through it. And by doing that, if they end up seeing significantly better, this implies that maybe their glasses aren't quite up to date or they need glasses or a change in their prescription. The reason why is when you look through a pinhole, this turns your eye into a pinhole camera. Now, I'm not going to go too much into the optics here to explain how this works, but I'll do a little bit. A pinhole camera, I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things, but it looks like a box that's dark inside with a little tiny hole punched into one wall. You can make one of these using an old coffee tin, for example. You just punch a little hole in the lid, put some photographic film on the bottom of the thing, and then you set it stable somewhere. And the theory behind it is if you have a small enough hole going into this camera, light coming off a specific object will come through that hole into inside the camera and hit a single spot on the film in the back of the camera. And light from a different area will always go through that hole and hit a single spot. So everything is in focus. And it doesn't matter how close or how far away that object is, light can only fit through that little tiny hole. So it comes in straight and strikes a single place in the back of that camera. So a pinhole camera is always in focus. Distance, near, it doesn't matter. It doesn't need to be focused. Pinhole cameras are nice in that way. A lot of small cell phones have pinhole cameras in them. And if you notice using a cell phone, there's not a whole lot of focusing. Everything's kind of in focus. Nicer cell phones have cameras now, and they do focus. But little tiny spy cameras, little tiny camera phones, they have pretty good focus. Now compare this to like a big giant SLR camera. Those things, you have to focus perfectly. Because if you don't, things are out of focus because they have a nice big aperture. And so the bigger the hole going into the camera, the more you have to focus. Now, SLRs take great pictures because you get that wonderful blurring effect in the background so you can really focus in on your object. But the point being, pinhole turns your eye into a pinhole camera, and so things come in focus. So if your patient ends up seeing a lot better when you put that pinhole occluder up there, it kind of implies that maybe they need to be focused better. Maybe their glasses are out of whack or they need glasses. But the pinhole technique, we do it one eye at a time, typically. Anyway, we'll come back to this pinhole, especially when we're talking about cataracts, but let's move on. Another technique that we can use for checking vision is called the BAT or BAT test. It's the Brightness Acuity Tester technique. And the idea behind it is you check your patient's vision, and you shine a flashlight in their eye, a little pin light right next to their eye, and you see if it creates any glare problems, if their vision drops off a lot. if it does drop off a lot, that kind of implies maybe there's a cataract, because a cataract is a cloudy lens inside the eye. And if it's cloudy, if you shine a light from the side, it'll glare the whole thing out, makes it harder to see. So if someone has a lot of glare disability, the BAT technique can sometimes pick it up. In fact, there is a BAT tester. It's a little handheld flashlight that has a little tiny dome that shoots a light and it lights it up, and our patients hold it and they look through that dome to a little hole cut out in the middle of it. And it's a little bit more objective way to measure BAT testing, you know, because you can set the brightness inside that little device to keep it more consistent, at least in your office, but the BAT technique. Another aspect of vision is our patient's near vision. This is especially important as we get older and develop presbyopia or difficulty reading without reading glasses. And so we typically will measure that with a near card. We just give the card to our patient and we tell them to hold it at whatever distance they want. It doesn't really matter. For most people, I tell them it's probably best to hold it where you like to read. That way we can tweak your glasses. But when checking near vision, you're just trying to get an idea how well do they see close up. And some people who have very bad distance vision will do better with a near card and vice versa. Now, unfortunately, the near card does not use the same Snellen measurement. The near card was developed by a Dr. Jaeger, and so we use a Jaeger scale. And that scale has a number of numbers. It's called Jaeger 1, Jaeger 2, Jaeger 3. But we'll typically say a patient with perfect vision is a J1 plus, which corresponds about 20/20. A J1 is a 20/25, J2 is 20/30, J3 is 20/40, and so on. So you'll typically document near vision as J1 or J2, etc. Finally, when we document vision, we typically write it down, and there is the convention of OD, OS, and OU. And in case you don't know that yet, OD means the right eye, ocular dominant, I forgot the Latin, OS, ocular sinister, it's the left eye, and OU, ocular urticae, I believe is how it's pronounced, urticae. OU is both eyes. And so that's how we write it down. There's a couple more vision checking techniques, such as the pinhole PAM, but we're going to hold off for that for now because we're still on the vital signs. Let's move on to the second vital sign. The second vital sign are the pupils. And the pupils are that black hole you see when you look at the eye. The iris, the colored part of the eye, has a little circular hole right in the middle of it. And that little circular hole can change shape, and that's what we call the pupil. And the pupil is where light enters inside the back of the eye to strike the retina and the back. Now, the size of the pupils is an objective measurement of the eye's overall afferent input. And when I say afferent, and I apologize for using terms like that, I hated this stuff in neurology. But when I say afferent, I just mean the eye's ability to sense light in general. Because when light enters the eye, if it's too bright, it makes the eye hurt, and the pupils will constrict down, and if the pupils will constrict, you know the eye is seeing. So it's how much the eye can actually sense. This is a nice measurement. This is the first time we have something somewhat objective, because if a patient comes in and they say, you know what, I can't see anything in my right eye, it's completely black, it's like I'm in a coal mine 1,000 feet down, but if you shine a light in their eye and the pupil constricts, this is an objective sign that, yes, indeed, that eye can sense light. It doesn't exactly tell us where the problem is, but at least the pupils give us a nice measurement that there's something going on here. This is also useful for people who can't communicate. We see a lot of people who can't speak, infants, for example, or demented, or after a stroke, but you can shine a light in their eye, and you can at least tell if that eye is sensing light. We typically will check the pupil reaction with a pen light, but you know, most pen lights that people carry in their pockets aren't quite bright enough to really get a good pupillary constriction. So the brighter the light, the better, either brighter flashlight or we use a muscle light, which is a little light ophthalmologists use. But when we're measuring pupils, we're measuring two things. The first thing we're measuring is the direct response. How much does that pupil that you're shining the light in, how much does the pupil constrict? So that's direct. How does it directly respond to you? But we're also looking for a second response. We're looking for the consensual response. Because when you shine light in one pupil, the signal goes from the back of the eye up the optic nerve, crosses over and goes to the other eye, and both eyes will actually constrict. So we're looking for a direct and a consensual response. I'm not going to go over the pupillary pathway. It's not important, but just realize when you shine a light in both eyes, both pupils should constrict by roughly the same amount. So the consensual response. This brings up a problem though. You know, we can try to estimate a pupil's ability to respond. We can try to estimate someone's ability to detect light in their eye, but it's really hard to measure. For example, let's say you have a patient come in A young woman, she has a history of multiple sclerosis, and she's complaining of vision problem in her left eye. And you suspect that there may be some type of afferent, some type of sensory problem, some problem with the optic nerve behind the eye. And so what do? We check the pupils, and you shine a light in her good eye, and both pupils constrict from, let's say, 4 millimeters down to 2 millimeters. Great, a direct and good consensual response. Everything is working properly. But let's say you shine the light in her bad eye, in her left eye, and both pupils constrict from 4 millimeters to 3 millimeters, so not quite as much constriction. And the question here is, was there a pupil defect there or not? Did we actually detect anything or not? Well, I don't know about you, but determining 3 millimeters versus 2 millimeters on a real live patient looking at their eye is very hard for me to measure. I mean, it's hard to tell because it's not always an obvious thing. And so that brings in our favorite test when checking pupils called the swinging light test. The swinging light test is very good for looking for relative problems. Let's give you for instance, if you take a healthy patient and you take your flashlight and you shine it in their good eye, both pupils will constrict. Now, as you move that flashlight from their good eye to their other good eye, the flashlight will travel over the bridge of the nose. And so both eyes are temporarily in darkness. And so they'll start to dilate a little bit. And then when you hit the good eye again, both eyes will constrict. So if you're looking at the eyes themselves during this whole process and you swing your light back and forth every couple of seconds, you'll see constriction of a pupil, constriction of a pupil, constriction of the pupils, constriction of the pupils. As you go back and forth, the initial movement that you see, the first thing those pupils do once the light strikes them is they're always constricting, constricting, constricting. Don't worry about constricting, it wobbles a little bit. There's something called hippus where the eyes kind of vibrate, but you look for that initial movement. So with a healthy person, you'll get constriction, 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 constriction. Perfect. Now let's take our patient with our multiple sclerosis. We suspect the left eye, the one eye, has a problem, but we're not sure. Now in that patient, if you take the flashlight and shine it in their good eye, both eyes constrict down to 2 millimeters, great. And if you hop over to the other eye, both eyes will actually seem to dilate up to 3 millimeters, just a little bit. It's not much, it's usually a subtle thing. And so as you go back and forth between the eyes, you'll actually see constriction, dilation, constriction, dilation, because that one eye is just dilating both eyes up to 3 millimeters. It's subtle, but this is a great way for picking up very mild afferent problems, very mild pupillary defects. And we call this an APD, afferent pupillary defect, but more accurately, it's probably better described as an RAPD, a relative afferent pupillary defect, because we can only pick it up relative to the other eye. If you had a patient who had two optic nerve problems equally as bad, as you went back and forth, the pupils would look normal. So this is a great way for picking up pupillary problems relative to the other eye, the swinging light test. Some people call the APD a Marcus Gunn pupil, but don't worry about that. If that was a little confusing, there's videos online, and I'll cover this a little bit more when we talk about neurology and the pupillary pathway. The third vital sign is pressure. Eye pressure is another one of those objective measurements where we try to estimate what the internal fluid pressure is inside the eye. And this is very important for glaucoma, especially. While we think of pressure as an objective measurement, it's not really that objective. There's no way to truly know the internal pressure of the eye short of drilling a hole through the side of the eyeball and measuring the pressure directly. But you can estimate the pressure inside of an eye by pushing on the outside of the eye. And pushing on the outside of the eye is called applanation. And the theory behind it is the Imbert-Fick law. That's not really a law, it's more of a rule. But the theory behind it is that if you have a sphere of fluid inside of some type of covering, like a balloon wall, you can estimate the internal pressure of that sphere by measuring how much pressure it takes to indent the side of that sphere. In other words, it's like kicking a car tire. You can estimate the internal pressure of a car tire by kicking on it with your toe. You have an idea of how big your toe is, how much force it took to indent it, and by using those measurements, you can estimate the internal pressure of that tire. Same thing with the eye. And in fact, that's what we do. It's called a Goldman applanation tonometer. And it's a little gadget that attaches to the slit lamp microscope that has a little piece of plastic that you illuminate with blue light, and it pushes on the surface of the cornea, on the front of the eye. And it pushes on that eye, and you apply pressure until it flattens an area of about 3 millimeters in diameter. And once an area of the cornea about that size is flattened, the machine has a little measurement. You can tell how much pressure was applied, and it calculates the internal ocular pressure. When we do applanation tonometry, we use fluorescein dye. It's a man-made fluorescent dye that glows bright green under a blue light, and a numbing agent because it doesn't feel good to touch the eye. So we numb the eye up, put fluorescein in there, and that fluorescein dye makes it easier to measure that exact 3 millimeter area, diameter circle. And then the machine kind of calculates out what the pressure is inside the eye. So Goldman applanation is the gold standard still of measuring someone's eye pressure. Now, doing Goldman applanation was one of those skills as a med student I was terrified of, because this is the first time you're like shoving something onto a patient's eye. And it's sometimes quite challenging to get a good measurement, looking through the microscope, holding their eyelid with one hand, turning a dial with the other. But once you get good at Goldman applanation, it's not that bad, which is easy for me to say, right? There are other pressure techniques for estimating the eye pressure. One of them is called the tonopin. This is a little electronic gadget that kind of looks like a really big electronic magic marker. It's white. And basically, it has sort of like an applanation tip on the end. And you can basically hold this up to the patient's eye, and you tap on their eye. And this little gadget will actually sort of estimate the pressure as well. It's a little hard to use, though. Tonopins are commonly used in emergency rooms. And because they don't have a lot of training on how to do it, it's almost like a random number generator. Even for us in the office, it doesn't always give us the most accurate reading. It's not nearly as accurate as a Goldman. But sometimes this is the only way to measure pressure in someone. If you have someone who is in a stretcher at the bedside, or maybe in the middle of surgery, or maybe you're doing an exam under anesthesia for a pediatric case for a young kid, you know, there's only one way to measure the pressure in those settings. You can't hold their heads up to a microscope. You got to use something handheld. So that's the tonopin. Pretty expensive device, only has one button. I guess the manufacturers figured that medical people weren't smart enough to work more than one button, but it's a little hard to get used to. And they're also pretty expensive. I've seen them $2,000 to $4,000, so the things are a little crazy. You know, there's an older technique called a Schiotz tonometer, which basically did something similar to that, but it had little weights built into it. I've never actually used one of the things, but I don't think anyone's really using them these days. Another way to check the pressure is the air puff. Basically, it's a little gadget or a little machine that shoots a puff of air at the eye, and it measures how much the cornea distorts, and knowing how much pressure pushes on the cornea. It's the same idea as applanation, but instead of physically touching the eye, you're blowing at it. We don't normally use this in ophthalmology because it's maybe not as comfortable for the patient because they don't like the puff. And it may not be as accurate, though I know some optometrists will argue against that. But it is used, and because there's less training involved learning how to do the thing. It's not as hard. Finally, if you have, let's say, a child and you're just trying to get an idea what their pressure is, you can't do any of these tests, then sometimes we'll do finger. We'll just have them close their eyes, very gently press on both eyes, and try to guesstimate what their eye pressure is. Extremely inaccurate. I mean, we say soft to palpation, but I really can't tell the difference between high and low unless it's just rock hard versus super soft. So soft to palpation is not the greatest method, but sometimes you don't have any other options. Okay, well, that pretty much ends the three vital signs: vision, pupil, and pressure. Have I beaten this to death? I can't believe how much we've talked about it. But let's move on, because there's a lot more eye exam. And let's wake up if you can, stretch, and we'll move on to the extraocular movements. The extraocular movements, also called the EOMS, extraocular movements, okay, is basically how the eye is moving. The eye sits inside of the eye socket like a scoop of ice cream inside of a waffle cone, and there's muscles that attach to the eye that pull the eye in different directions so we can see up, down, left, and right. Eye movements are very important for obviously seeing what you're seeing, but they're also important for binocularity. How are the eyes moving in relationship to each other? Typically, when we are documenting or looking at eye problems, we look for two things. We look for ductions, which is how each eye is moving independently. Can an eye look out to the side and look in every direction? But we're also looking for versions, which is how are the eyes moving compared to each other? For example, can they converge? I mean, can the eyes move inwards? For example, if you want to read something on a book, your eyes got to turn in a little bit. And can they diverge? Can they move back outwards for looking far away? And when we measure the eye movements, it's not that complicated, but the main thing we check is a couple positions. We want to check how are the eyes moving in primary position, looking straight ahead. Arguably, the ability to have straight eyes looking straight ahead is the most important thing. So we check the primary position. Are the eyes crossed? Are they out? How are they looking? Then we check the cardinal directions. And the cardinal directions are the most important physiologically. And so think of a big H, big capital H in the air. And so we check, you know, how do the eyes look side to side and in the upper corners. Up, directly up and down is not as important, but basically we just have them look at our finger as we move around in these different directions. So we check primary first, then we check the cardinal directions. Now, if there is an eye problem, if the eyes appear to be maybe out of synchrony, or if you have a patient who's complaining of double vision, there are a couple of more tests. One we can do is called the cover-uncover test. And the idea behind it is you say, look at my nose or look at a spot on a wall behind me, and you take a little paddle and you cover one of the eyes, and then you uncover that eye. And you repeat a couple times and you look for the eyes moving. And if the eyes shift, then you know that the one eye is basically resetting or refixating on that object. So you know that the eyes must be out of alignment. Another test we do is a cross-cover test, and that's where we try to break the fusion of the eyes down. Because someone may have a tendency for their eyes to turn in, they may have a tendency towards cross-eyed, and yet they've got pretty strong muscles and they're able to avoid cross-eyed most of the time because both eyes can fixate on the same object. Except when they get really tired, they start complaining of eye strain. Well, we can do a cross-cover testing where you break the fusion, you break the ability of the eyes to work together by covering one eye, and then instead of uncovering the other eye, you immediately move your paddle so it covers the other eye. And so you're hopping back and forth between both eyes and never get a chance to really work together, and you look for eye movement problems there. And if their eyes start to drift and refixate a lot, then you know that they have a tendency towards having what we call aphoria, which is when the eyes want to wander off, especially when they get tired. Now, eye movements can be very confusing, especially looking at tropias, phorias, cover-uncover, cross-cover testing. So don't worry. If you really want to learn more about this topic, I have a pretty good video online. You can find that at optobook.com or look for tropias versus phorias on YouTube, and I'm usually the first video there. But I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. The next thing we look for on an eye exam are confrontational fields. How is someone's peripheral vision? Because a third of the brain is devoted to vision, and if there is a problem in the brain or the visual pathway, we can often pick that up, which is important for someone who you suspect maybe has had a stroke or advanced glaucoma. And so will we normally do this at the bedside or in the chair with finger counting? Can you count how many fingers I'm holding when I hold it in different areas in your peripheral vision? And once again, we do this one eye at a time, but both eye binocularity, not that important for the most part. So we'll have them cover one eye and make sure they don't cheat, because they're going to cheat, especially those kids. And you say, you know, just look right at my nose. And as you're looking at my nose, what you do is you hold up your hand and you hold up either one or two fingers in different areas in their side vision, and you see if they can tell you how many it is. Don't go try doing three, four, five fingers, because it's just going to confuse everyone. You'll get in arguments over whether the thumb is truly a finger, and it's hard to tell two versus three. But so just stick with one versus two fingers and move your hand in different areas and see if they can count it. The good thing about having them watch your nose is you can watch their eyes while you're doing this and make sure they're not cheating. Also, if they have a tendency to cheat, like they just can't help themselves, they look over towards your hands, and people do this. Some people just don't have the mental faculties or concentration skills to keep staring straight ahead. Then what you can do is you can hold up two hands, one on either side, your right and your left hands are up, and you don't tell them which one's going to come, and then one of the hands, you shoot up one or two fingers, and you kind of alternate it every once in a while. So they never know quite where to look, so they look at your nose, and you can really tweak this out. Another tip is you may want to, but you really want to hold your hands at an equal distance between yourself and the patient. The theory there being, if you can see it, the patient ought to be able to see it too. Because if you hold it, there's no way to know otherwise. And you can even try closing one of your eyes so that you're getting almost a mirror image of what the patient ought to see, and then you document things. Now, there are other ways of getting visual fields, and there are more exact ways. The one we use most often in the office is called a Humphrey visual field, Humphrey with an H. And it's a computerized machine that patients sit in front of. They put their head into this little bowl of light, one eye at a time. They have an eye patch on the other eye. And the computer shoots lights in different areas of their peripheral vision randomly. And they have a little buzzer, and they click it every time they see the light. And basically, the computer tries to map out any problems in the periphery. So Humphrey visual field, we use it a lot. Every eye doctor probably has one, because it's very important for monitoring for glaucoma in particular. There's another machine that is becoming less often used called a Goldman visual field, Goldman with a G. And that's a really big machine that has a big giant bowl of light. And your patient, once again, sits in there with one eye at a time, stares straight ahead. But this machine has a almost like a flashlight or a laser pointer that moves around and makes the actual light move. So it's not coming on and off. It's actually moving into their peripheral vision. And as soon as they can see it, the patient hits a buzzer. And you have to physically draw out on a little map their peripheral vision with different size lights, different powers of lights. And it's pretty good for patients with really, really bad glaucoma. You know, some people have such bad vision or bad side vision that they just can't do a visual field test. The machine, it just can't be done. Or maybe they have a concentration issue and you really need to like do this manually. So that's when we do the Goldman field. Now, the Goldman is a big bear. As a resident, they made the residents do it because I don't think the technicians wanted to do it. And so we would hate our Goldman days doing these fields because everyone had terrible vision and it would take 20, 30 minutes sometimes to get a good field out of it. It was good practice. So I'm not complaining, but Goldman fields are a bit of a pain. And also, I don't think they're making the machine anymore. And so they're slowly breaking down across the country. It's hard to get parts. You look on eBay for this stuff, but a Goldman visual field. So confrontational fields, hand movements. Most people do Humphrey visual fields with glaucoma. And finally, the Goldmans for specific cases. One final tip, though, on the old visual field. So far, when we document things on an eye chart, we pretty much document, like if you're going to draw a picture, you draw a picture of their eye as if they're looking at you, like you're staring at them, almost like you're an artist. So on your piece of paper, the patient's right eye is actually on the left part of the paper, and the patient's left eye is on the right part of the paper. And that's how we document everything, pretty much, except for visual fields. Visual fields, you document not like they're staring at you, but you document it as if you're the patient drawing out what you see. So you draw the right eye on the right side of the paper and the left eye on the left side of the paper. The reason why is probably because they used to do visual fields using tangent screens. There are big screens on the wall, and you'd sort of sit behind the patient, and they would bring a wand with a light in and until they could see it. Also, it gets really confusing otherwise. So, for example, if you have a patient who has lost their upper right quadrant of their vision in their right eye, so the right eye, they can't see anything up and to the right. On your piece of paper, you're going to have two circles, and in the right circle, the right eye, and the upper right quadrant, you're going to have a black area drawn in there. So everything is as if you are the patient staring at the piece of paper describing what you can see. So anyway, that's confusing. I just write OD and OS over the circle so there's no confusion, but it's written backwards. And this brings us to one of the more intimidating areas of the eye exam, the slit lamp eye exam. Now, the slit lamp microscope is kind of intimidating because it's a big, complicated microscope. And most medical students or optometry students have never really worked with one of these things before. You may have played with a microscope in high school science class, but one that's on its side like this is quite different. Now, the microscope, there's different makes and models. Hoogstraete is one of the more classic ones. That's what I trained with. Zeiss, I've used those as well. In my office, we're using Topcons, but they all pretty much have the same features. They have a microscopic binocular head, so basically a microscope with two eyepieces. There's a light source that can create a beam or slit of light, like a very thin sliver of light. And both the microscope and that light source intersect at a certain point in space. And that little point in space can be pushed onto the eye and allows you to look at different structures. And the eye is pretty cool because it's not flat like a pathology slide. The eye has a lot of depth to it. It's a 3D structure. There's corneas, there's lenses, there's iris looking back to the retina. And because of that, the microscope is designed so that beam of light can be shot into the eye to create cross sections. You can actually see a cross section of the cornea or a cross section of the lens, just like a CAT scan can give you a cross section of the body, which allows you to tell the depth of problems. You can see where an infection is. Is it in the superior cornea or the back of the cornea? You can see where a cataract is. Is it the middle of the lens or is it coming in from the sides? I mean, you can really see the depth of objects. And so the slit beam microscope is quite a useful device and what we spend the most of our time during an eye exam doing. Now, when you're documenting an eye exam using the slit lamp, there are a number of things you need to write down. In fact, there's eight structures you really need to comment on your note. And I've never really come up with a good mnemonic for how to remember these eight structures, but it's probably best just to think working away from the outside, working your way to the back of the eye, that way you don't forget anything. So anyway, I'm going to list these out real fast, and then we'll go through each of these structures real quick and sort of the findings that we might see and how we document it. But I'm not going to belabor this because I have a pretty good slit lamp exam video online on YouTube. Just look up slit lamp exam, and I'm usually the first result there too. That kind of goes over this more detail and shows you what the slit lamp looks like, how to use it, and the different things we may see. So anyway, the eight structures back on target here. The first one is EXT. That's the external. The second one is LL, lids and lashes. The third one is CNS. That's the conjunctiva and the sclera. The fourth one is K, the cornea. Fifth one is the AC, the anterior chamber. The sixth one is the eye, the iris. The seventh one is L for lens. And finally, eight is V for vitreous. All right, so let me go over each of those once again, if you don't mind. But like I said, just start from the outside, work your way back, make sure you have eight things written down. Number one, EXT, external. We're usually talking about the eyebrows and the skin around the eye, but not really the eyelids themselves. So we're looking at the cheek, we're looking at the nose, and looking at the brow. And you don't really need a microscope to do that. In fact, the microscope's not actually that good at looking at the nose, cheek, or brow. But it's good to document it anyway. And we're looking for things like zoster, if they get shingles on their forehead, or some type of big bug bite on their eyebrow. Or maybe they've got rosacea of the nose, like it's really obvious, and that might cause blepharitis or some type of dry eye problem. But normally, almost always, we just document this as normal or within normal limits, WNL. The second structure is the lids and lashes. And we're basically looking at the outer eyelids and the inner eyelids. On the outer, we're looking at the eyelashes, looking at the meibomian glands that produce oil that run inside the eyelashes. We're looking at the punctal drainage. This is a little punctum, little tiny holes in the sort of the medial lids that drain tears from the eye into the nose itself, making sure those look normal. We flip the inside of the lids outwards, and we look at the inside of the lids, and that's called the palpebral area or palpebral conjunctiva. If someone's complaining of, you know, eye irritation or a foreign body sensation, then we'll flip the upper lid too, which is a lot of fun. But normally, if there's no problems, then we would just say that lids and lashes, normal. The third thing, the conjunctiva and the sclera. Well, we haven't really gone over a whole lot of anatomy, and I'm probably going to do that in the next lecture. But the conjunctiva is that thin layer of skin on the surface of the eye. When people get a conjunctivitis, it's an itis, an inflammation of the conjunctiva. That skin gets irritated, the blood vessels dilate, they have a pink eye. So the conjunctiva, that thin layer of skin. And we look to see if it's injected. That's what I usually, if it's injected, 1+ injection, 2+ injection, is it? Are those blood vessels injected? Are they dilated? Is it red? You might also see things like chemosis, which is a swelling or fluid collection underneath there. You may see a subconjunctival hemorrhage. That's just some blood that's bled underneath the conjunctival skin. It looks really impressive. As a med student, it seems like I was always documenting icterus, I-C-T-E-R-U-S. I think I spelled that right. Icterus, a yellowness of the eyes, looking for jaundice. And I guess that's a big deal in the medical world, but we hardly ever see it in ophthalmology. I don't even think about icterus. And so, anyway, but normally if the conjunctiva and sclera, and the sclera is the white part of the eye, if they look normal, then we'd write white and quiet. The fourth thing we look at is the cornea. And for some reason, the abbreviation we use is K. So cornea with a K. And we're looking at the cornea for clarity, abrasions, scratches. And that's really where the slit beam comes in handy. I've already mentioned this. You know, that slit of light can create a cross-section. You can sweep across the cornea and make sure everything looks clear. And we're looking for scars and ulcers. And we also use fluorescein on the surface of the eye to look for spots of dryness, for example. But if the cornea is normal, we would document that as cornea clear. The fifth thing we look at is the anterior chamber, usually documented as AC. And that is the space behind the cornea, but in front of the iris. It's a little pocket of water there where things can potentially occur. And the main thing we're looking for is cell and flare. Basically, the eye is the only structure we can actually see inflammation there. You know, people have inflamed knees, you're just going off of symptoms. But the eye, you can look in there and you can see individual cells floating in the anterior chamber. Little macrophages or white blood cells just floating around in there. Or even blood cells, you can see little tiny blood cells. And they look like dust motes in a movie theater. If you've been to a movie theater recently, just look up at that projector beam right when it comes out of the projector booth. And if you see little dust floating in there, it looks like little spots floating in that beam. That's what it looks like when we look inside the eye. That's what we call cell. We also look for something called flare, which is more of a general haziness. And it occurs because a protein from inflamed blood vessels may be released. And protein is much smaller than cells, obviously, so you're not going to see individual proteins floating in there. But you will see a haziness to your beam of light as it goes through it. So if you go back to our projector beam analogy, flare, that protein, it looks like smoke. So if you're in a smoky theater with lots of dust, cell looks like the dust particles, and flare is this, the smoky appearance of the beam itself. So we look for cell and flare. But if the anterior chamber is quiet, there's nothing going on, then we would document that as deep and quiet. The sixth structure we look at is the iris, and that's probably the easiest thing to look at because for the first time we have something relatively flat, and it's easy for a microscope to focus on things that are flat. And oddly enough, you would think there'd be lots of pathology here, but the iris is almost always pretty benign. People can get nevi and even melanomas on the iris, but much less common than on the skin. We look for things like neovascularization. Patients with diabetes, they have a tendency to grow abnormal blood vessels inside the eye, and so that's one of the places we look is on the iris. But for the most part, the irises are normal, so we document as normal. The seventh structure is the L, the lens, and here we're looking for things like cataract. And a cataract is when the lens becomes cloudy as we get older, and that cloudiness causes blur. Most people over the age of 40 or 50 have a little bit of cloudiness, and we'd usually call that an NS or a nuclear sclerotic cataract. Or they may have a cortical cataract coming in from the side like spokes on a bicycle wheel. And this is usually documented on a 4-point scale. So if you have a person with a moderate cataract, you may say they have a 2+ NS, nuclear sclerotic cataract. But if the cataract at the lens is clear, then we would just say clear. So lens, clear. The eighth and final thing documented on a slit lamp exam is the V, the vitreous. And the vitreous is that big area behind the lens that fills up most of the eye. And the vitreous is actually, it's a fluid that has a consistency very much like Jell-O dessert. And when we look at the vitreous, we're basically just focusing behind the lens, and we're looking for cells, which could be inflammation or blood back there. We might be looking for pigment floating in there, which looks a lot like the cells in the anterior chamber. Pigment might occur if you have a retinal detachment. But almost always, the vitreous is normal, and so we would just say vitreous clear. So those are the eight structures we look for with a slit lamp exam. And once you get good at it, you can blast through them pretty quickly and really hone in on problems. And this brings us to the final exam thing, the retina. The retina is the light sensing structure in the back of our eye. You can think of it like film in a camera. And the retina is quite unique and pretty darn interesting, if you ask me. It's the only place in the body that you can actually see blood vessels directly. I mean, everywhere else is pretty much covered by skin. I guess you can sort of see veins on the surface and maybe some stuff in the cuticles, but the retina, you can actually look directly at blood vessels, and this gives you a sort of an indirect view of the vascular system for the entire body. You can look for emboli and plaques, atherosclerosis, signs of hypertension, etc. The retina is also the only place in the body that you can actually look at a nerve directly because the optic nerve enters right into the retina. You're looking head-on at a nerve, and you can see signs like papilledema or swelling of the nerve or other issues there. So the retina is a pretty neat thing. Unfortunately, it's quite hard to see because you have to look through the pupil into the back of the eye, and the retina is not easy. In fact, this is another place that most students struggle with at first. There are several tools for looking in the back of the retina, and the first one we ought to talk about is the direct ophthalmoscope. Now, the direct ophthalmoscope is the little handheld thing that most primary doctors and med students carry around with them. And it's basically a little tiny miniature microscope that you hold right up to the eye, and it gives you a view of the retina. Extremely hard to use. I remember as a medical student, we would all sit in a big circle and they would give us a direct ophthalmoscope. We would try to look in the back of each other's eyes, and I don't know. I don't think I actually saw anything back then. We just had to sort of fake it and pretend like we did. But the direct ophthalmoscope, very hard to use, even for an ophthalmologist, especially in an undilated eye, extremely hard to see what's going on back there. And part of the difficulty is lining the thing up to the patient. And the biggest problem, in my opinion, is that the view you get of the retina is so narrow and so small, it's really hard to find your bearings and figure out where you are. Because it's like looking at a painting of the Mona Lisa through a straw. You're like, okay, is that her forehead? Is that her mouth? It takes a while to find your bearings, especially if you're not, you know, really comfortable with the anatomy to begin with. But normally what we'll do is, you know, we'll try to find a blood vessel and hopefully work our way in one direction until you find the optic nerve and see if you can see it back there. I'm not going to give you a whole lot of tips for using the direct ophthalmoscope other than good luck. But the one thing that's going to help you the most using this tool is to get it as close as you can to the patient's eye without touching their eye. The closer you can get that instrument to the patient, the better the view, the larger the view, the easier everything's going to be. And so what I tell people to do is, you know, just create a sandwich. Hold the ophthalmoscope, the direct ophthalmoscope, and let's say your right hand. Take your left hand, your thumb, and stick your thumb right on your patient's eyebrow, like right on it. And then take your direct ophthalmoscope and rest it on your thumb. So you've got a sandwich, forehead, thumb, instrument. Because by doing that, you can get it really close to their eye without worrying about actually, you know, bumping it into their eye and then look inside the eye. The closer you get it, the better you're going to see. Also, just set your instrument to zero. I know there's all these numbers and they try to tell you to offset it to your prescription. Just set the zero and then flip up and down until you get a good view. But the direct ophthalmoscope, I don't use it that often, quite frankly. In fact, I don't think I've used a direct ophthalmoscope in 6 months. I know a lot of neurologists will use them because they don't want to dilate the pupils and they want to see what's going on with the nerve. But for the most part, not that useful in ophthalmology and optometry. A slightly more useful tool is called the panoptic ophthalmoscope. This is also another handheld device that's quite a bit larger, and it gives you a little bit wider field of view and makes it a little bit easier to see in the back of the eye. Now, I didn't have one of these when I was a medical student. Only the rich kids and neuro-ophthalmologists had one because they were so big and they were so heavy that it just weighed my white coat down, and so I never really had one of them. But I do know a couple of neuro-ophthalmologists that use them for the same reasons. It gives it a little bit wider field of view. It's a bit easier to use than a direct, but it's bulky, it's more expensive, it's hard to transport to the bedside for the most part, but the panoptic. The most useful way that we use in ophthalmology and optometry for looking at the retina is right at the slit lamp. We can actually use a 90 diopter lens. It's a little tiny, very powerful magnifying glass that we hold up in front of the eye, and coupling that with our slit lamp microscope, we can actually get a really excellent view of the retina. It's a much wider field of view than you get with the handheld stuff, and it's great stereopsis. You can really see elevations like retinal detachments or elevated optic nerves or swelling in the retina. Every patient pretty much will get viewed with one of these 90 diopters during a routine eye exam. Other people have preferences. There's 70 diopters and different brands, but I think most people use the 90 diopter for the most part. One of the challenges using a 90 diopter lens, though, is that the view you get is flipped. It's reversed. And so up is down, down is up, left and right are flipped as well. And so you have to kind of get used to looking at the retina backwards. In addition, the beam that you're shooting into the eye, normally you still shoot a slit lamp in because the bigger your beam, the brighter it is, and the patients, they squeeze down, it's hard to see. So it takes some getting used to. And also you have to learn how to focus back there. But once you get good at it, the 90 diopter lens is what most people use. The final lens that we use is the indirect lens, and this is for looking into the periphery for retinal detachments. The indirect ophthalmoscope is a head-mounted microscope that basically goes on your head and has a beam of light that shoots out, and we'll hold a big 20-diopter lens in front of the eye and have our patients look up, down, left, and right, and it allows us to see back there. It gives a much, much wider field of view than anything else. The downside, though, is it's hard to get used to using it. You can't see that well with it. The view doesn't have quite the same stereopsis. It's not good for looking for little things like macular degeneration or optic nerve issues. But if you're looking way in the periphery, it's really the only way to do it easily. Sometimes you can't even get out to the periphery. You can't see the edges of the retina for small tears or holes. And in those cases, we'll do something called scleral depression, where we're kind of pushing on the eye with a little, either a Q-tip or a little metal device to kind of indent the eye so we can see way out to the side, but patients really don't like that. But the indirect ophthalmoscope, probably not within the purview of a general practitioner, but certainly we use this on a daily basis with our patients in optometry and ophthalmology. As far as evaluating the retina, there's really only four structures you need to document, and I have come up with a mnemonic for this. I call it the MVPD, the most valuable player dude. This is the only way I can remember it. But the M is for macula, that's the central vision. V is for vessels. P is periphery, looking for retinal detachments or holes. And D is for disc, the optic nerve itself. So MVP, most valuable player, dude, if you had to remember it somehow, but that's the only way I can ever remember it. So M, macula. You know, you're looking for signs of macular degeneration, looking for a good reflex. But if it's normal, I'll just say macula, normal. V is for vessels. And we're looking at the blood vessels, the arteries and veins coming off the optic nerve and spreading through the retina itself. And we're looking for emboli and clots and other abnormalities, but for the most part, we'll write down normal if it's normal. P is for periphery, and we're looking for retinal tears or holes or other issues out there. I'll usually document flat 360, no tears, no holes, something along those lines. And finally, D is for disc, the optic nerve, and I'll normally document normal, pink, and healthy, and we'll usually come up with a cup-to-disc ratio. The disc is the size of the optic nerve, the optic disc. You don't need to know the exact size, but if there's a big cup in the middle, because there's usually an indentation inside of it, the cup-to-disc ratio is a sign usually of glaucoma. People with glaucoma, they lose a lot of nerves in their optic nerve, and so you'll get an enlarging cup-to-disc ratio. We'll talk more about this in glaucoma, but we'll usually document it as a ratio. So for example, a normal might be cup-to-disc ratio 0.3, meaning that their cup is 30% the size of the overall disc itself. Once you get 0.5 or higher, you start getting nervous about glaucoma, but it really kind of depends on the appearance itself. MVPD, most valuable player, dude. Hopefully that'll help. Now we're winding down to the end of this little talk, but before we do, I'd like to go over a couple of reader questions that I pulled from ophthobook.com, my website, because I think it's useful sometimes, especially with a topic like this, to hear other people's questions. The Socratic method is very useful for honing in on important theories, important talks. So our first question is from Loretta, and she asks, what does it mean by fundus not visualized? Is this a normal or abnormal finding? That's a good question. Fundus is typically talking about the retina. Fundus is actually Latin for bottom, and there's a fundi or fundus in many organs throughout the body. For example, the stomach has a fundus, the gallbladder has a fundus, the uterus has a fundus. Anything that has sort of a bowl-like internal shape to it is usually described as a fundus. When it comes to the eye, we normally describe the fundus as the retina on the back of the eye, especially the area that's easy to see using a 90-diopter lens. And so another way to call this is the posterior pole. So if someone says the fundus is not visualized, that usually means they just can't see in the eye. Let's say you have someone with a really bad cataract. I can't see their retina. The fundus is not visualized. Or a kid, they're so squirrely they won't let you look inside them. Fundus not visualized. Someone mentally retarded or is just moving around so much or squeezes their eyes shut, you might document it as fundus not visualized. Another way to document this would be posterior pole not seen or unable to see posterior pole or something along that line. So fundus is how we describe that. Also, when you take photographs of the retina, it's usually called fundus photographs because that's where we're taking a photo of. So good question. The second question is from Mahmoud, who asks, what about the red reflex? My professor is obsessed about it. Would you please make a video about it, doctor? Okay. The red reflex is basically what does their retina look like when you shine a light at them. You just hold a flashlight right next to your eye and point at the patient and see what their red eye looks like. Quite frankly, I don't use the red reflex that often, but it is kind of useful. Normally, I'm doing a complete eye exam anyway, so I'm going to find any problems. But there is a couple of places that the red reflex is important. Certainly, pediatricians use it because they can look for a red reflex in a child. If you have a child with no reflex out of one eye, you got to kind of get nervous that something's going on, like a retinal detachment back there, so you're not getting a good red eye, or a retinoblastoma or some terrible tumor. Certainly, pediatricians do the red reflex a lot. They're also good if you have a patient who you're trying to figure out why they can't see, and it's in the middle of the night and you haven't dilated them yet, but you kind of want to know what's going on, you'll check their red reflex. And if they have really bad vision and no red reflex in one eye that happens suddenly, then, it's probably either retinal detachment or their eye's full of blood or something. And so it's kind of like getting a preview of what else is going on. The red reflex is also somewhat useful for strange cataracts. For example, you have a patient who has got a little bit of cataract, but gosh, they've got a lot of complaints. They really are complaining of problems with their vision, and you can't seem to refract them any better. Well, you do a red reflex, and every once in a while, I say, oh my goodness, you've got this weird opacity right in the middle of your lens that I didn't even notice under a slit lamp microscope. It's almost like you've got like a bubble of oil or something in the middle of your cataract. And so the red reflex can be useful for that. One last area that I like to talk about with the red reflex is there is something called the Bruckner test. I believe this is spelled Bruckner test. But it's occasionally used by pediatric ophthalmologists and optometrists who are trying to estimate a child's refraction, see if they're nearsighted or farsighted. And the theory behind it is if you use a light and you shine it in their eye, you can kind of see where the red reflex is the strongest. And if it's strongest on the bottom of their pupil, like it really lights up on the bottom, sometimes it's an indicator that the child's nearsighted. If it's strongest on top of the pupil, then that often will indicate that they're farsighted or hyperopic. If you have brightness that's much brighter in one eye compared to the other, it might mean that one of the eyes is deviating outwards or inwards, or it's not lined up properly, and that's why the reflex isn't quite as intense. So the Bruckner test, I don't use it that often in my practice, but I figured I should mention it. The final question, I don't have the person's name, they didn't leave it on my site, but it's says the following. I believe I am legally blind without my glasses. What does that mean? Well, you bring up a great question, and we're often asked by our patients, you know, what is legal blindness? Am I legally blind? Legal blindness basically means that the best vision you have in your best eye, when it's corrected, when you're wearing the proper glasses, is 2200 or worse. Basically, there's lots of people out there who are really nearsighted who, if you didn't check their vision with their glasses on, they'd be legally blind. They can't even see the big E on the chart. But it doesn't matter. Like I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, we don't check people's vision unless it's corrected because it's meaningless otherwise. So basically, if your vision in your best eye, it's your best eye, and you've got the proper glasses on, they've been checked recently, and they're as good as they can get. If you still can only see 2200 or worse, then you're considered legally blind. At least that's the law in the U.S. There's another law that says you're legally blind if your vision is 20 degrees or less in your best eye. So we have people who have, let's say, retinitis pigmentosa, which is a genetic problem where they lose a lot of their rods and they lose a lot of peripheral vision, who technically have excellent 20/20 vision when they're sitting in the exam chair. They can read pretty good on the eye chart, but their peripheral vision's so bad, it's like they're looking through straws all the time. And so they have really bad peripheral vision. They wouldn't be safe to drive, and they have a hard time getting around and doing things. And so if their visual field in their best eye at the best is 20 degrees or less, then that's also considered legal blindness. So 2200, 20 degrees, corrected best eye is the definition of legal blindness, at least in the U.S. Well, I think that about wraps things up. I hope you found this useful. I know it's actually went over an hour. I'm surprised. But I hope you found this useful. And if you'd like to see the show notes for this, you'll find them at italkradio.com. You can also go to ibasics101.com. It'll take you directly to this page. Look for episode 1. And I think in our next talk, we're going to talk about the basic eye anatomy, and we'll go over some of the structures there. But until then, thanks for listening.
Dr. Root would like to remind you that this program has been created for educational purposes. The opinions stated here should not be considered medical advice, and this information is not intended to replace a direct consultation with a medical doctor. If you have an eye problem, please consult with an eye doctor to accurately diagnose your condition and tailor a treatment specific for you.